Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic podcast. I've talked about René Girard before. I talked about him in my book, Conspiracy. I don't remember exactly when I heard of René Girard's theories, but they did suck me in, and they're fascinating. And I think they're worth reading because they explain one of the most fundamental driving forces in the whole world, which is, why do we want what we want? And what does wanting stuff make us do? Now, the Stoics talk a lot about sort of desire and curbing desires. They don't get as much into the psychology, the sort of the societal forces, the historical forces that make people desire and crave this versus that, that suck people into conflict with each other, whether they know what the sources of that conflict actually are or not. So I was so excited that Luke Burgess reached out. He has a new book called Wanting, The Power of Mimetic Desire in Everyday Life, which is, I think, the most accessible and beneficial entry point into Girard's theories. Peter Thiel, who I talk about in Conspiracy, is one of the sort of main proponents of Girard's works in the world. He has, a nonprofit even that supports Girard's legacy and work after Girard died. But Peter Thiel recommends Girard's book, Things Hidden Since the Beginning of the World, which I have read, but let me tell you, it is not Marcus Aurelius or Seneca. It is not accessible. It is so dense. One of the densest, hardest to read books that I've ever read. Luke's book, Wanting, is really, I think, a great entry point to it. I think he's trying to do with Girard's work what I've tried to do with the Stoics, what my friend Russ Roberts did very well with Adam Smith and his book, How Adam Smith Can Change Your Life. Anyways, I was fascinated to have this conversation. Shout out to Christo, my former research assistant and now all-around podcast genius, who helped me set this interview up and did some prep for me. So if you find that I'm more prepared than usual, you can thank Christo. Luke is a fascinating guy, not just a philosopher. He had a background in Silicon Valley. He started a company, as he talks about in the beginning and we talk about in the intro. Nearly sold that company to Tony Hsieh and Zappos. Sort of realized he was on a track that he didn't want to be on and went in a very different direction in life. He's an entrepreneur in residence and director of programs at the Catholic University of America, where he also teaches business. He studied at the NYU Stern School and at the Pontifical University in Rome, and he's the managing partner of Fourth Wall Ventures, a startup incubator, and he lives in Washington, D.C. He writes at lukeburgess.com. That's L-U-K-E-B-U-R-G-I-S, Luke Burgess. And check out his new book, Wanting: The Power of Mimetic Desire in Everyday Life. I think this is a great interview. We really get into a bunch of topics. So here is my interview with Luke Burgess on mimetic desire, René Girard, and getting to the truth of what it is that you want and should want in life. So I thought let's start with Girard, and let's start with you sort of explaining Girard's big theory and why it matters to people, or should matter to people, rather.
Yeah, so René Girard is a French polymath. He was a professor at Stanford for many years, but he's one of those rare people that didn't really have a specialty. He was kind of, studied history, and then he got into literature, philosophy, even theology, and stumbled on a discovery about human desire that really changed his life. And we should all be concerned with his discovery because, you know, human desire is just fundamental to who we are as human beings. It's one of the things that really differentiates us from animals. You know, we want all different kinds of things. And it's fascinating. We can talk more about the way that desire works. And that was his fundamental discovery, is that desire is not the way that we normally think of it in terms of being independent and autonomous, that my desires are entirely my own. Girard's discovery was that desire is mimetic. That is to say, we are infected by the desires of other people. Desire is contagious, for better and for worse. So desire is infectious and it's contagious because human beings are highly relational creatures. We're social. So the people around us affect what we want. And you know, there's this it's very different than the way that a lot of people, I think of it. This idea that became very popular in the middle part of the last century, that existence kind of precedes essence, that we're born into this world and that we decide what we want, we decide who we want to be, and we just kind of fashion that. That we can't do that, because by the time we've already begun to desire a certain identity or certain things, we've already been exposed to what other people want and other people around us. So this idea of mimetic desire is kind of the starting point of a lot of different connections that Girard made to our culture, to the way that people's identities are shaped, to the question of rivalry and competition, which has impact in the way we think about economics and markets and politics, all kinds of connections. He even went so far as to say that mimetic desire is kind of the root of conflict. It's actually explains violence, which is, most people don't think that the root of violence could actually be imitation. This idea that because we're imitating what other people want, we're naturally pulled into rivalries with them. And, you know, Girard, if you take his theory far enough, I don't really like to try to give it all in one nugget because sure, there's so much to take in, right? That eventually leads to ways to resolve that violence through scapegoating and things like that.
Well, and what's fascinating about Girard as a philosopher is that he doesn't sort of discover this, you know, as a psychologist, as a sociologist. It's not this sort of deeply specialized academic study. It comes really, as I understand it, from his sort of deep reading of classical literature. Like he derives mimesis from some of the great novels of history.
Yeah, isn't that how we discover a lot of great things, is when we're kind of outside our domain of expertise and we can bring a different perspective to it? So that's absolutely right, Ryan. He discovered or saw mimetic desire in classic literature. And I think it's just because, you know, Girard was a genius in the way that we don't normally think of geniuses in this way, but he was almost a genius of human nature and being able to see certain aspects of humanity that nobody else could see when people over-intellectualize things. So all of the, you know, popular literary critics of his day kind of missed this fundamental insight that he had by bringing his historian and anthropological lens to classic literature. And he noticed that a lot of the characters in some of the greatest novels in history, like Dostoevsky, your brothers Karamazov, the characters were highly mimetic. Like if you follow their arc through these stories, they never have any desires just spontaneously. We have this idea of spontaneous desire, but Girard saw that these characters in the novels had their desires modeled to them by other characters. And that if you kind of trace that path, this is the way that the story takes shape, through the way that their desires are modeled. So sometimes literature reflects back to us deep truths about life and about human nature that we're almost too close to see in ourselves. And that's the beauty of reading fiction and reading great literature. And Girard saw it there. And then he began to look other places. He looked around him. He looked at phenomena in the culture. He looked inside of himself, and he realized that there was this fundamental deep, deep truth that he was able to spot.
So if we're sort of surmising Girard's theory, and I did this briefly in one of my books, I'd sort of do it as it's not, we don't want what we want what other people want. And to use the title of your book, it's this wanting, this sort of mimetic desire that is the source of a lot of misery, also a lot of conflict, but it's also just this sort of unknown, unexplored driving force through history and humanity and relationships. And that the better we sort of understand this, the more likely it is that we can get to the actual truth of things rather than just acting on, you know, what we think is the truth, but is actually this sort of mimetic or filtered desire, this reflection back to us of what we think we want because the people around us want it or have always wanted it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, imitating other people's desires is not very palatable to most people. We don't really like to think of ourselves as imitators at all. That's why this is really hard to get at. People typically understand this at an intellectual level way before they understand it at an existential level. And this is a question of identity. And Girard would say that mimetic desire ultimately is about us wanting to be a certain kind of person. We're like seeking a quality of being. That's why we pick the kind of models that we pick. So, you know, I was, Ryan, when you were probably writing your first book, I was at an age when I was just trying to pull myself out of this deep muck of some really nasty mimetic desires. And I just didn't, you know, I'd never heard the word. I hadn't even heard of Girard at the time, but I just couldn't make sense of, you know, I was a striver. In many ways, I still am. And, you know, hustle culture, you know, as a prototypical entrepreneur, I was on the hypermimetic track from, you know, good undergrad business school, the Wall Street to Silicon Valley. But I was just caught in these cycles of like great passion followed by disillusionment. And I didn't really understand why, but I was just surrounded by other people that were constantly signaling different things to me at different times for status, whether to like appear in some kind of a cool entrepreneurship magazine or make some list or telling me about what their companies were doing and what they wanted to do. And what I didn't know at the time is that they were greatly affecting my desires. And it was like whiplash. Like one day I'd want one thing and the next day I'd want another. I started a company. I lost the desire to go into my office every day. So like realizing that a lot of our dissatisfaction and our confusion and the things that we pursue may not in fact be what's going to truly lead to happiness, right? Because we haven't had the time to understand the origin of our desires. So one of the first steps in becoming a little less mimetically reactive is just actually taking the time. And it, you know, it took me until my mid to late 20s to do this. Like, where did I get the desire to do this thing or want this thing in the first place? Like, what's the origin of that? And probing it a little bit, because there are great models of desire. I think the Stoics are a great example of that. You know, they model a certain way of being and a certain kind of humanity. They certainly weren't my models at the time. All of my models were what I would call horizontal models. They were just basically other entrepreneurs. It's like, how do you ever get out of a certain cycle when you're in that world?
Yeah, I think I was just doing a video about this, about sort of what it's like to sort of get what you want in life, to accomplish something. You know, your book's a bestseller, or you sell your company, or you, you know, you start a company, or whatever it is, you accomplish something. And then there's always this sort of disappointment that comes when you get that. And I think part of that is because material accomplishments, external things, can never sort of fix internal problems. You know, materialism, material items never really sort of deliver what you think they're going to deliver. But I also suspect a large part of this is we realize at some fundamental level that we just got something that we didn't actually want to begin with. We only chased it because that's what you're supposed to want. That's what everyone else has said is good. And it's only after spending years of our lives, or all of our time, all of our money, or whatever, accomplishing it, that you go, oh, I don't even like this. You know, I just bought this sports car, but I don't care about driving. None of this is registering with me in any way. We get that sort of refractory sort of wake up call and regret because it wasn't our desire that was drawing us towards it. It was this mimetic desire, you know, sort of kicked off by people and forces we never really questioned.
Totally. You know, and I think we have thin desires, which are these highly mimetic desires. And when we pursue them, perhaps because there's somebody in our life that we really admire, or somebody that's had some success with a book or something like that, and we adopt this desire. It's an adopted or borrowed desire. And along the way, somewhere along the way, we really convince ourselves that the desire is entirely our own, without having actually taken the time to do the self-examination and understand those thicker desires that really do make up kind of these perennial human desires, the things that we know lead to happiness, the things like the pursuit of truth, you know, philosophy, faith, meaningful work, friends, family. Those things are, you know, those things can be mimetic too. The desire for those things can be mimetic in a tremendously positive way. You know, I've had great models in my life of, you know, good husbands and good fathers, and I want to be infected by the desire to be more like those men. So it's a matter of like distinguishing between, you know, what are the unhealthy mimetic influences and what are the positive ones, and then be more intentional about picking the models.
Yeah, there was a great tweet I saw a couple months ago that was like saying that, you know, every NBA player now wants to be a venture capitalist, and every venture capitalist seems to want to be a stoic philosopher. And the joke being, and this has been true in my experience, you meet these people who are at the top of this profession or that profession, or have seemingly accomplished all the things that you would think you would want to accomplish in life. And really, all they actually want is to do some other thing that they think, either it's because they chased a mimetic desire and got somewhere that they have no interest in actually being, and their sort of real core purpose is this other thing that's only now are they sort of coming to terms with, or it's this sort of moving of the goalposts where they can never want what they have. They have to want what somebody else has. And I always, one of, this is weird to go to your point about some positive mimetic desires. One thing that sort of reassured me and reminded me not to stray too far from my path as a writer, because, you know, you do get these other opportunities, is how it doesn't matter whether I'm meeting like professional athletes or billionaires or political leaders. Deep down, they all seem to want to be writers. And it's sort of going like, okay, if everyone wants what I have, why am I trying to want what they have? I should just actually enjoy this.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the irony of it is that there's always another model. You know, desire by its very nature is for something that, you know, we don't possess, really, at least in Girard's definition. So the irony is that if you follow a model and you pursue what that model is pursuing and you get the thing, then you have to find another model, because maybe you're not entirely fulfilled yet, or you assumed that you chose the wrong model, and the world is filled with billions of them. You have to wonder what social media is doing, because, you know, for me, social media is just a model machine. It's just a way to find them within 5 seconds by opening up your phone. And there's always going to be another one. And if we don't we don't find a way to break that cycle. It's just that constant, never satisfied striving. And absolutely, I mean, there's an element of like wanting what we have, right? Whether that's being a writer or whether it's your marriage or something like that. And there's this beautiful aspect of learning to desire more deeply the person or the things or the career that you already have. It's not like once you have it, you know, desire is static. Or, you know, so there's always, you can always go deeper into it. And that's certainly the case with love. Just to your point about being a writer, right? Like other people aspire to do that. And it kind of makes you stop and say, I don't know, Ryan, I mean, I don't know about you, but I have days where I'm like, yeah, you know, I just wrote this book and what a hard life. This is one of the hardest things that I've ever done. You'd be like, well, I've got NBA players that would like to write a book.
Sure.
So you can go a little bit deeper down into to your writing, I think.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. Yeah, and there is a great line from Marcus Aurelius where he goes like, think about how badly you would covet the things that you have if you didn't have them. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's sort of what you see in a lot of these people, is that since they have what they have, they're taking it for granted. And then they're wanting all this other stuff. Instead of going, look at everything I have. Look at how much this is. Look at how much this is more than I could possibly need. Look at all the ways that I have to be creative or fulfilled or have impact or make a difference with what I'm doing. Instead, they just see this sort of grass is greener. Well, you know, it looks like writers are having a great time. It looks like so-and-sos are having a great time. I suspect that this is, for instance, like why influencers are so popular. It looks like whatever field they're an influencer is. Like, you know, I follow like farmers who are influencers. I follow writers who are like, you follow these people who have large social media followings. And what you really are just looking at is going, I think their life is better than mine. And so I want their life, not my life.
Yeah. And we don't know anything about their real life. You know, we just know what's being represented or projected to us. Like I follow
it's
the
filtered
van
through
life.
An algorithm.
It's filtered through an algorithm, and not only the algorithm, but also filtered through what they want to show us.
Totally.
You know.
So let's talk about, I guess, what you might call the sort of the great, the most influential acolyte or sort of evangelist of Girard's theories, someone who we've both spent some time with. And I liked your scene in the book about sort of at his house in Hollywood, where I've been a few times and when I was writing my book, Conspiracy, Peter Thiel seems to be largely the reason that Gerard is, I don't want to say relevant, but has sort of the reach that he does, particularly in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I mean, I always ask people that are familiar with mimetic theory how they discovered it. And it depends on where you're at. If you're in Silicon Valley, I feel like 9 out of 10 people will say Peter Thiel. Or 2 or 3 degrees of separation from Peter Thiel. If you're in other places, they may have discovered him through other means. Yeah, but Peter, you know, has really made Gerard well known, and you know, has cited Gerard as being highly influential in forming his own thoughts. You know, Peter was on a very hypermimetic kind of track early in life. And, you know, he describes Gerard giving him some keys to understanding the world and some of the things that were happening during his undergrad days at Stanford, where, you know, Gerard was never actually his professor, but Peter kind of found out about him and went to some luncheons and things where Gerard was talking, and really helped him at an existential level as well. Now, you know, for better or worse, you know, people have kind of like, usually people have reactions to Peter. You know, I think he's got a brilliant mind. He's applied Gerard's insights in a particular way. You know, he's cited Gerard in helping him understand how powerful Facebook would be. He's formed some political philosophy around Gerard. But I would point out that, you know, Gerard is rich with all kinds of insights that are seminal and can be applied in very different ways. So, you know, I interviewed Peter for the book, and we had a fantastic, fascinating conversation about Gerard. But sometimes I worry that people will read 0 to 1, or they will see Peter's interpretation of Gerard and think that it's the only one.
Yeah, it's funny. I joked to a friend once that perhaps like the ultimate way of proving Gerard's theory, but also trolling everyone, could be that Peter has taken this philosopher who's incredibly dense, one might argue is completely abstract and sort of not practical, and by being a famous sort of billionaire technology investor and saying Gerard's theories are important, I'm a big fan, has made them mimetically relevant.
Yeah, well, that's the funny thing about mimetic theory is that Peter himself is probably a model for thinking that mimetic theory is important and cool.
Yes.
It's kind of a joke among Gerardians, like the people that maybe are most attracted to mimetic theory may be like just more mimetic people by nature or something like that. You know, and Peter has had a huge influence on that. You know, I doubt that if he was a billionaire, people would care as much about this kind of obscure philosopher at Stanford. So I do think Gerard's thinking is very important. So I'm glad that there's a Peter Thiel to draw more attention to his thought. One of the things that I wanted to do in the book is just kind of, you know, broaden the audience and try to connect it a little bit more to popular culture and to relationships so that it's not just about, you know, here's how I can invest and make a bunch of money in Bitcoin, or framed in just certain kind of tech world framing. I think you did your book Conspiracy, I don't know, I'm going out on a limb here, but I'm guessing it's probably not the book that most people, you know you for.
Sure.
It also probably seems like it was the hardest book to write. That's just me as a reader.
But definitely.
I think it's really, really important because you, without really talking a ton about mimetic theory explicitly in the book, you are getting at the way that rivalry plays out, that scapegoating plays out, and you presented kind of a different side to mimetic theory than what Peter did in 0 to 1.
Yeah, it's. I'm glad you wrote your book because you do make Gerard much more accessible. And as someone who's sort of in love with the Stoics and the writing and sort of writes about philosophy without a philosophical background, I don't think there's any way around the fact. Around the truth that Gerard is not particularly good at writing for an audience or for just like coming out and saying what he means. I mean, is it things hidden since
Things Hidden since the foundation of the world. Yeah.
Is that the one I'm forgetting? I've read a couple. Is that the one where it's like presented as this fake dialogue between him and like two other unknown people? Which one is that?
Yeah, that's Things Hidden. In fact, several of his books are in the form of dialogues, which I think is really interesting. But yeah,
I like dialogues, but this is like, what the fuck are you doing? Just write it as you. You know, it like there is a sense of like just not being straightforward and accessible in Gerard that I find frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, that book is very hard. I think it's brutal to read. You know, I studied philosophy formally, and you know, from what I hear, like Peter recommends that as like the starting book for Gerard. I don't know if that's he's just like trolling people or what. I mean, I would never recommend that to most people, at least as where to start. It's extremely obscure. I've read it like 10 times, you know, and I still am confused by some of the stuff in it. And it is written in this weird kind of like form of a dialogue. It jumps all over the place. It's kind of like Straussian. You have to read between the lines. And Gerard, I mean, let's be honest, and he's an academic and he's got a very odd kind of obscure style where he never does seem to say what he means. And I think part of that's because that was an early book. And I feel like he's like working out what he's trying to say in the process of the book or the conversation itself.
Yeah, I think that's part of sort of French philosophy too, which is there's almost this like, well, if I just come out and say what I want people to do and how this works, then I'm not being the brilliant sort of French academic philosopher. And then, you know, I don't know, the world will collapse. What I like about the Stoics is it's like, you could not reduce the equation any further, right? Like it's the fraction is simplified to the smallest possible form. Whereas with Gerard, there's so much that has to be simmered down to get to the actually quite insightful and important sort of conclusions that he's coming to. Like it's weird. I was thinking even, and I went through this, I read a Moreau book recently as well, where like, how do you even quote one of these fake dialogue books? Like who am I attributing this to? Is this Gerard or is this Gerard arguing with himself? Is it all Gerard? Are these two people in this dialogue, are they real or not? You know, it's like, what is happening? I can't even make heads or tails of it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a weird format. And it's in a sense, it's like really the opposite of the Stoics in terms of the practical applications. I mean, Gerard almost never tells anybody like what he recommends they actually do. Right. It's like, you know, you read this book and you've got to just kind of like figure out like what this means. Like, what does this mean for how I live my life? I mean, it's like so different than reading like Meditations by Marcus Aurelius or something like that, where he actually gives practical advice. Gerard is not like that. I tried to fill that gap a little bit with Wanting and like giving some recommendations, some things that I did. But at the end of the day, I mean, if you want to become a less rivalrous person, for instance, and have a little bit more peace about you, the way that you do that is going to probably look a lot different than the way that I've done it in my life. So, you know, you can't hand people like an instruction manual. There is an element of like assimilating this into your own life and figuring out what this means about the way that you're in relationship with your models.
Yeah, there's almost kind of a test of the theory in the books, which is like Gerard has all, you know, he's a Stanford professor. He's, you know, widely perceived to be brilliant. He's got Peter Thiel advocating for him. He's, you know, you could argue the ideas have never been sort of more verified in some ways with some of the stuff that's happening in the world. And then you as a person have to go, is this nonsense or is this real? What do I think as the individual, regardless of what other people are saying? Because if you read Gerard and you go, I don't get this, but obviously it's true because Peter Thiel says it's true. In a sense, you're proving Gerard, but you're also disproving Gerard, and the validity of Gerard is credibility. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I do. I think I know what you mean. I do think we can sort of verify in ourselves if we're honest and courageous enough to do it. We can kind of verify that, yeah, like I do have mimetic desires, you know. When we get into like different levels of abstraction and we see like what's going on with so-called like cancel culture, you know, we see what's going on with social media, then it's a little bit, you know, to the scapegoat mechanism, for instance, if we're going to draw a connection between cancel culture, then that just becomes a little bit trickier, because you have to, like, there are so many different like steps that you have to take in memetic theory to get to the point where it all kind of comes together and you can kind of see some of the things that are happening through that lens, that, you know, you can't, it's just not like a meme, and there's like a lot of work involved in that. So to just tell somebody like, oh yeah, it's a scapegoat mechanism, right? In this blasé way. They're like, well, I don't fucking know. Like, maybe, but it could also just be like, you know, people just, you know, being bad people. So I think, I don't know. I think we're saying a very similar thing, right? Like, to what extent can this be verified? I do think it can be verified at sort of the phenomenological level, the easiest in terms of our personal lives.
Well, it's kind of like one of those critically acclaimed sort of art films where you have to go watch it. And it may well be that it's just a horrible, overhyped movie, or it may be that you have to get yourself in the right headspace. You have to have some of the background. You have to done some of the pre-work, and then you watch it and you're like, oh, this is acclaimed for a reason. And it might not be as obvious or as immediately accessible as, you know, the latest sort of Marvel movie, but there's a brilliance to this that is even perhaps even more profound, and it's just not as easily appreciable.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, when you can see something with a different frame, it can really open your eyes to different layers of meaning. I mean, that happened to me with like the Big Lebowski. I think like the first five times I watched it, I was like, holy shit, I keep seeing different things in this movie. It's actually funnier than I thought it was. So yeah, and I think I've tried to put the focus a little bit back on the existential level, because that's where the rubber hits the road for me. Like, how can this actually like improve our lives? And one of the issues I see with memetic theory is that you have a lot of people that just like to talk about memetic theory on this very like intellectual and abstract level, which sort of sometimes makes me wonder if it's just kind of like this. It's become memetic in itself almost, right?
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors here, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stoic. That's netsuite.com/stoic.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like, every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Yeah, I mean, what I appreciated what you said earlier is there's a way you take this philosophy and you use it to like either manipulate people or make a little bit more money. And there's an aspect of sort of my popularization of Stoicism that people criticize, where it's like, oh, this is just, you know, philosophy for bros or something. And I think actually it's there to make you a better person, and it needs to be made accessible, because it in its original form it's not quite accessible to people. But the idea for me of mimetic desire and understanding is that it helps you make better decisions and get clarity about things that you see or hear in life. So like what I found with Peter Thiel when I was writing Conspiracy is that people often label him as contrarian, and that this is actually incorrect, because a contrarian just does the opposite of whatever people are doing, right? Like, I don't know, Diogenes the Cynic is sort of a contrarian. He's just sort of acting asocially all the time. What I've found to be true about Peter Thiel is that on a lot of big questions, like, you know, kids should go to, should kids go to college, or, you know, stuff like this, instead of just taking it for granted and agreeing with everyone else that the sort of that, of course, everyone should go to college. College is very important. This is a question we've worked out as a society. Peter takes some sort of quiet time and sits down and he just actually figures out what he thinks. Now, it is the case that oftentimes he has a sort of a heterodox or unusual take on these things, but it's not that he's reflexively rejecting what other people think. It's just he took kind of a sacred cow that everyone assumed was something you can't think about originally and came up with an original take about it.
I think that's right. I mean, you can be highly mimetic and be a contrarian. If, you know, like everybody else is like looking for the keys in the only spot where the light is, so I'm going to go like look in the dark. You know, that's probably a really good investment strategy, but not all the truths in the world are like contrarian. I mean, there are some truths that are actually like perennial truths. And, you know, if we think that, you know, the truth is always kind of like contrarian and like the thing that nobody else is saying, I mean, that can lead us down some super like silly paths that I think we see a little bit in academia right now. So like not everything is contrarian. And you can also be like, well, Peter Thiel is this contrarian. So, you know, I need to be contrarian. And therefore, I'm just going to like have a different like take than everybody else. I mean, you end up just being super mimetic that way. It's kind of a funny thing. So I think what he does is what is positive there. I mean, just the category of being a contrarian, we could talk about like the metaphysical desire to be a contrarian. Like, why is that a positive thing? What he does is he takes critical distance from issues without getting caught up in everything that the crowd's saying. And I do think that's really important to do in life, to be able to think a little bit more independently, to not be able to get sort of like caught up in that mimetic moment. I don't know if anybody else has had this experience. I live in Washington, D.C., and like sometimes I'll be walking down the street and somebody will like accost me and like try to sell me on something or some new bill that's going to be passed. And you can like almost like get swept up talking to them and like agree with them. And then you walk away from them and you're like a couple of minutes down the sidewalk and you're like, wait a second, what in the hell was he just saying? Like, I don't agree with that at all. Right.
So like, sure.
It's like being able to have the self-possession and the critical distance when everybody else is going one way, just to actually, it's not about being contrarian. It's just about like taking the time and creating some critical distance so you can figure out what in the heck you actually think about this thing.
Yeah, this is something I talk about in my book on stillness, the idea of not getting caught up, not taking the emotional reaction, not thinking what everyone else is thinking, but really stopping and go, yeah, what are the facts here? What are my beliefs? Why do I have those beliefs? What is this outcome likely going to be? You know, and just thinking about it independently. So I wouldn't say that Thiel is a contrarian thinker. I would say the compliment is that he's an independent thinker. Now, do I often disagree with the conclusions he comes to independently? Sure. But that's sort of the point, is that we should all be independently thinking and not necessarily working towards some sort of consensus. If everyone is agreeing, then it's likely that we're not doing much thinking at all, and there's probably a lot of mimesis at play.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know if there really is like 100% pure like independent thinking, right? Because even that, you know, we're part of a long line of thinkers, and you know, we're sort of, whether we believe it or not, you know, here we are in 2021 and, you know, we build on the shoulders of giants and we're sort of in the stream of knowledge, right? And we're also very, very much affected, not just on the level of desire, but on the level of ideas by the people that are surrounding us, by what they're thinking. That's one of the reasons I actually think, and I try to make an intentional effort in my life to have some people around me at all times that I know just come from a completely like different frame of mind, right? And just like completely different presuppositions to constantly like sort of test my assumptions. And I think that's a pretty healthy thing to do, because like everybody thinks they're an independent thinker. Like, that's the problem. Everybody thinks they're an independent thinker. Even you know, when they're sort of caught up in the crowd. So I think like putting some structures in place in your life to prevent that illusion are really important.
And I found, you know, sort of surprising and kind of inspiring about Peter, and it sounds like you had some of these experiences too when you're writing the book, is that I don't know what I thought he did all day, like what his job was, but I was surprised that it was like mostly these sort of long meals or meetings or parties. And I couldn't quite wrap my head around it. Like, why is this person talking to me for 6 hours, you know, just over a really long dinner? And then I realized, and I think Eric Weinstein said this to me, he sort of described Peter as an applied philosopher, and that sort of really as the head of this sort of, you know, fund and investment and sort of whatever, all the sort of things he's responsible for, his job is just to kind of think about things and to come up with views or opinions about where the world is going or why it is the way that it is. And he gets there by having conversations often with people that he disagrees with or doesn't have much common ground with. And he sort of gets these theories or these ideas, and then those theories become investing theses and sort of get filtered down through the organization. And then people whose job it is take much more you know, sort of direct action based on these ideas that he may have gotten from his dinner conversation with you about an obscure French philosopher from Stanford.
I think that's right. I think Ray Dalio is similar in that respect. And like, these are people that spend a lot of time thinking, and that's the real kind of value that they add. I've heard stories about Peter that, you know, he's just had a conference room at Thiel Capital, and he's had 6 or 7 people around a table for 5 or 6 hours, literally just talking about some old book.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, what's interesting about that, and he has Jeffersonian dinners that I think he likes to organize, where you kind of mash up really interesting people in a room. You know, some people might be sitting next to other people that they would never come into contact with if they were self-selecting. Those are powerful experiences. And, you know, there's this relationship between action and contemplation. I think a lot of people that are kind of caught up in the hustle culture, like I was for most of my life, it's just go, go, go all the time without an appropriate respect and understanding of the role that the contemplative life plays in action, and being able to change perceptions so that when you're acting, you know why the hell you're acting and like what you're moving toward. And I think not just the billionaires should spend more time thinking about ideas. And Peter loves to think about and talk about ideas with other people. I think like we should all have a desire to do that and to just spend a little bit more time, you know, nurturing that contemplative part of life and having the long dinner conversations and lunch conversations. Because I think it kind of like magnifies our action when we do take it.
Yeah. I was thinking about, as I was reading your book, you know, you open with this sort of story of Tony Hsieh from Zappos trying to buy your company, and it, you know, doesn't end up working out. But I was, and I'd recently read the Wall Street Journal piece sort of about his tragic and sudden demise. And it struck me just how easily one can sort of get sucked into a lifestyle, a way of life, you know, a unaddressed sort of emotional and physical issues. I saw sort of a downward spiral there that struck me as very sad, but in some ways the sort of hints of it were kind of always there.
Yeah. I was sensing that, you know, in 2007 and 2008, and, you know, rest in peace, you know, Tony really, you know, he's a good soul, and you know, I don't know what happened towards the end. I read the same Wall Street Journal article that I think you did, you know, but there were certain signs of some deep unhappiness in that community at the same time that everybody was talking about how happy they were.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if everybody has to go around all day, every day talking about how happy they are, like that's weird. Like they're probably not very happy, because like truly happy people don't have to do that. So there were signs, and you know, I don't want to, it is the way that I open the book, so I don't want to give you the end of the story, but there was this experience that I had in my relationship with Tony and Zappos outside of my control in a certain sense. This is kind of where I really began to embrace Stoicism. Events that were completely outside of my control that happened that I didn't realize until months and probably even years later were kind of like the best thing that ever happened to me, because I sometimes ask myself if those events that kind of pulled me out of this, I would say like mimetic cycle that I was in, they hadn't happened. Like, I don't know what would have happened to me. I mean, I might have been kind of sucked into some of the things that were in that article in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, it's you know, by the grace of God, there go I, right?
Yeah, right. No, you could have sold your company and then, you know, you become sort of enmeshed in the sort of cult of personality, or, you know, you get sucked into the sort of what seemed like a sort of a drug culture, which strikes me as a, actually the sort of, in you know, there's been a handful of these sort of mimetic sort of spirals that Silicon Valley has sucked in. You know, so you have cryptocurrencies, which at the moment seems like quite a lucrative one, although there are moments where it's crashed and, you know, cost people a lot. There also seems to be, you know, these obsessions with these kind of weird, seemingly dark rabbit holes, whether it's suddenly everyone's into polyamory, or, you know, suddenly everyone's wearing these weird shoes with, you know, finger toes, you know, or suddenly, you know, suddenly everyone is flying down to South America because we all need to do ayahuasca. There's this kind of like everyone's unhappy. No one wants to question how much this has to do with San Francisco and the meaningless companies that they're creating and the sort of the wealth that they're chasing. No one wants to question that. It actually is this sort of profound human issue that needs to be addressed with medication or, you know, questioning how relationships are. There seems to, and then because the other smart people are doing it, we all have to do it. And then everyone follows the leader right off the cliff.
Yeah. Well, you were way ahead of the mimetic wave, Brian, about moving to Austin. I think everybody's moving to Austin and Miami right now.
Yes.
Been there for a while, right? Yeah. I mean, ideas are just kind of like fashion and these weird rabbit holes and things that people cluster around. 100%. And, you know, I think that Silicon Valley and entrepreneurship culture is a great case study in mimetic desire. You know, all of these weird sort of like lifestyle things, like most of us are spending more time on social media over the last year because of the pandemic. You know, you sort of like wonder, like, sure. I think it's sort of like put us on a hyper mimetic track, because we're not engaging in like the deep human connection, like meeting up with friends, having dinners the way that we used to. Instead, we sort of substituted this like sort of deep layer of humanity for just kind of seeing what other people are doing or tweeting or saying or writing and reacting to it. So I do, if you had asked me, like, do I think like the world has become more or less mimetic over the last year? I think it's become more mimetic. And I really think that's kind of a function of like losing some of that humanity, and sort of, you know, we've sort of resorted to a lot of these kind of like thin desires that I think are highly contagious. Whether it's moving to a different city or having some idea that's fashionable, I think we've got to be really careful about that.
Well, at first it seemed like there was kind of a positive element of the pandemic in that regard, and that hey, since nobody's doing anything because they're legally not allowed to go do things, you know, maybe we'll compare ourselves less. We'll look inward and sort of see what makes us happy, and that, you know, there's less status anxiety when there are no sort of statuses to chase, and you can't be taking pictures of yourself in a private jet or, you know, flying off to Tulum or whatever. And then maybe it seems like a lot of this, that energy just gets sucked into conspiracy theories or economic sort of bubbles, whether it's cryptocurrencies or GameStop or, you know, the housing market. I wonder if just all these things, all that energy is always there and it just gets displaced or channeled depending on where it's possible for it to go.
Yeah, I think being displaced is a really good way to describe it. You know, we kind of saw that with all of the sports bettors that kind of just gravitated to the stock market, you know,
right,
and didn't bet on sports anymore. So it's almost like, you know, the energy isn't created or destroyed. It just has to like move somewhere else. And it kind of like flows to the point of least resistance. I have a somewhat contrarian take on speaking of being a contrarian, on like what's happened with the pandemic. And I think the prevailing narrative is kind of like, well, this has helped everybody figure out what they really want and like what's really important to them and prioritize. That's certainly true for many people. But I think I know an equal number of people that are actually more confused than ever about what they want to do post-pandemic. You know, they may have lost their job. They may be going through struggles. They see, you know, people making a bunch of money on GameStop. Like, there's just like a lot of noise right now. So I know a lot of people that are very confused and mimetic, which kind of goes against this idea that we're all just, you know, we've all prioritized and decluttered our lives and read Marie Kondo and everything, you know. So I don't know if that's necessarily the case. I think that it's went both ways. And I think, you know, we should be careful and think about like, what are the desires that we had like before the pandemic and that are going to endure long after the pandemic 4 or 5 years from now? Like, we might have a desire, some of us, to like, you know, go on a little bender, like once we can finally like go out and, you know, go to a dive bar and like, you know, exchange sweat with some people or something like that. But like, that's not going to give you any kind of lasting satisfaction or fulfillment. What about like the virtues and the values, you know, temperance, prudence, fortitude, those things that are important at all times and that haven't acquired some kind of like mimetic or very temporary value because of the circumstances that we find ourselves in?
Yeah, I mean, I think a good portion of society, and we sort of watched this sort of politically, and it's almost beyond politics at this point, but for every person who said, oh, you know, I really realized I want to travel less and I'm going to spend more time with my family and, you know, I'm going to start my own business, blah, blah, blah. A huge chunk of society has just become unmoored and untethered from reality altogether. And this is where, you know, they found themselves on the Capitol on January 6th, or, you know, they're obsessed about the hidden dangers of vaccines, or, you know, they get sort of untethered from reality because they've just spent so much time on the internet and people are saying things. And, well, if they're saying it, it must be true. And they don't really understand how to question it or think for themselves. And so I would agree. There's certainly been a darkness to it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I last year was the first year in 10 that I didn't have time. I try to take a silent retreat every year. There's actually a great place just outside of Austin called Laity Lodge, by the way. It's beautiful.
Okay.
And I try to take minimum of like 3 days and, you know, no devices, no technology. I typically just bring a couple of books just to like disconnect from everything. Like, it's one thing to do it on a daily basis. If you have a ritual, spend half hour every morning or something like that, that's fine. But I find that I need to do it on an annual basis, like kind of like a deep cleanse, you know, like deep cleanse, sure, of silence. And last year was one of the first years that I didn't do it. And I felt it. I actually like really felt the effects of not being able to do that. I find that it takes like 3 days, like before the cleanse actually even starts working. It's almost like 3 days of detox before I'm even in its normal state, where I can begin to like, you know, dig down and understand what it is I want to do that next year, whatever it is. And I felt it because I didn't do it last year because of the pandemic. There's really no excuse. I could have done it. It's totally distance and everything. I just didn't.
Yeah.
I think we would all benefit from taking a few days before we throw ourselves back into what we think we want to do post-pandemic, you know, and you can do that. You don't have to go to a fancy lodge or retreat center or anything like that. You know, you can make your own space to do that. But I mean, I'm certainly seeing the need for that in my own life. You know, as I've got a book coming out, and you can just get caught in, you know what that's like, and mm-hmm. you can get caught in a spiral and sort of never take the time to, you know, just to reflect. It's kind of that critical distance that we were talking about before.
Well, I had Matt Berninger on the podcast. He's the lead singer of The National, and we were talking about exactly what you're talking about, that, you know, you can have your little routines, you can think you're pretty good with managing, you know, having some quiet time or reflection. But, you know, it's like you go on vacation, you're like, oh, I need 2 weeks, you know, it takes me a couple days to get into the vacation. I think it was for me maybe like 8-9 months into the pandemic, not having gone anywhere, you know, not seeing anyone, sort of much more in the sort of reclusive writer mode, that it hit me. It's like, oh no, it doesn't take a couple days for me to get into the right headspace. It takes like 8 months, you know, that it was a long, long detox. And I think it is going to be interesting as stuff starts to come back online. Like I got invited to do something tomorrow. I got my second vaccine. And, you know, if I'd been invited to do this thing 3 weeks ago, I just would have reflexively said no, because it wasn't an option to do it, right? Like, per sort of how I'm thinking about things. But now that it's there and I can do it, and this goes to mimesis, other people I know are going to do it. Now I have to go, but do I actually want to do it? Like, do I need to do it? Is it worth, you know, is it, I've, you know, not missed a bedtime for the kids in 13 months. Is this what I want to break that streak over, or would I actually rather do bath time, you know? And so it'll be interesting as we sort of come back online, how quickly we just revert to old behaviors.
Yeah. I mean, just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should, doesn't mean that it's good for you. I mean, and it requires some serious discernment. You know, my fiance and I have had the same discussion. I'm super resentful of her, by the way, because we signed up for the vaccine and clicked submit at the same exact time, and she got hers, and I haven't got mine yet. So she'll be.
Well, you're in DC, so there it's mismanaged.
People are going outside of DC trying to find it wherever they can. So she's become a rival to me. I resent her for doing that. And by the way, people in relationships can become rivals to each other all the time. That's something to watch out with in a marriage or in a partnership. You know, it's we don't like to think of our own partner, the people that we claim to love, as rivals, but it can happen. So yeah, I mean, we've had the same discussions about all the things that are, you know, all the possibilities that will like open up to us. I mean, I'm like, I feel like I'm going off to New York City to be a freshman in college for the first time or something like that, right? It's like, you just do things because you can. And you know, I
things, you know, that you did not miss once over the last 13 months.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and we'll definitely need to do some good discernment.
Well, so to sort of wrap up with something you touched on earlier, you talked about how, you know, you've got this book coming out and you can sort of get wrapped up. I'm curious, because to me, this is the sort of the ultimate vulnerability. How do you think about success for the book, putting the book out, even writing the book? How do you sort of catch yourself from, you know, wanting what everyone else wants, whether it's your editor or the sales team or, you know, the bestseller list or the market? Like, how did you sort of approach this book, and sort of maybe what lessons have you learned as far as like keeping this, you know, I would argue rather toxic sort of impulse from creeping in to what should be kind of a pure and, you know, pure and sort of artistic process?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because, you know, writing a book has tested me in a lot of different ways. It would be disingenuous to say that I didn't want the book to be a bestseller. I hope that it is. I think it's realizing that that's certainly not why I wrote the book. I wrote the book because it was like a baby inside of me, like where if I didn't write the book to sort of communicate some of these things that have changed my life, I wouldn't have been happy. And the timing was right. You know, I was finishing the book after the lockdown. It gave me some time to really sit with it and to do that process of decluttering my desires and trying to figure out what it was that's really important to me. And ultimately, you know, while I want the book to sell well, because I do want Girard's ideas to reach a greater number of people, I think you'd probably say the same thing with Stoicism. Of course, you want your book to sell well. It simply cannot be the motivating force that gets you out of bed every day. So, you know, writing the book, one of the things that I had to do, there's a great community of Girard scholars, people that have said really amazing things and unpacked mimetic theory in all kinds of ways. And, you know, within the mimetic theory community itself, strangely enough. There's like all kinds of little petty rivalries, right? Like, you know, there's like the right and the left.
In academia, there's petty rivalries.
Exactly. Well, the smaller the stakes, you know.
Yeah, so the sharper like, the knives.
There's this conceit, these little petty rivalries about like interpreting Girard. And I mean, I would have driven myself absolutely crazy had I not, in a certain sense, like shut out sort of some of these more superficial desires to like make everybody happy or to like, you know. I mean, one of the worst things you can do as a writer is like have this like self-talk as you're writing about like, you know, is this sentence going to piss somebody off or like this thing that I'm saying? Just trying to communicate the truth as I understand it and as I experienced it in my life in a way that I hope ultimately will help people understand themselves and humanity at a much sort of deeper level. I mean, that's where the rubber hits the road for me. I don't really have an interest in the intellectual side of mimetic theory as much as I do actually like just helping people to live more fulfilling lives. And for me personally, in writing the book, there's constant temptation to, you know, I have a publicist and I've got a digital marketing team and everything. And it's like this constant tension between doing the things that I really want to do, like talking to you is one of them, and then just getting pulled in a million different directions and having conversations and doing things that are just the things that you're supposed to do when you write a book. And for me, it's going to be the you know, drilling down under the surface and having like the real conversations than just like the sound bites that are really important for me. Because I mean, ultimately, I think there's only one reason that you write a book or you do work, and that's because you want to actually like change people's minds and change their desires for the better and help them understand themselves better. And writing it was a process, you know, I mean, for me as well, refining my desires. And when I did have those kind of mimetic desires, you know, to do certain things, or to respond to a tweet that I saw or something like that, which I do. There's this constant calling myself back to like what actually really motivates me and what's going to bring me fulfillment 5, 10, 12 years down the road.
Yeah. I found that when I was writing Conspiracy, it was this weird thing when if I have any regrets about that project, I knew. So, I mean, on the one hand, you know, you're writing about a billionaire who just, you know, sued a, you know, very large publication out of business. So there, and then runs a secretive defense company. So there's a little bit of sort of wariness there. And then on the other side, you're writing about sort of professional journalists with a huge grudge, who have a very sort of strong view about things. And when I look back at that book and I think about things that I regret, the only things I regret are when I was conscious when it slipped into my mind how somebody was going to read this sentence, mm-hmm. right? So that I won't say I pull my punches, but there are places where I sort of thought I was too self-conscious, really. And I was thinking about what other people would want, not what I wanted to say. And so it's a tricky thing. It's kind of a paradox in when you do a creative project, because on the one hand, If it was truly a creative project, you wouldn't be putting it out in the world. You'd be doing it just for yourself. It is also a business venture in some way, and you won't get to do it again if nobody reads it. And why did you slave over the sentences if you don't want anyone to read them? And yet, if you allow exterior judgments to determine whether it was a success or failure, you sort of handed over your power. And so it was weird on that book too, where it sold well, you know, but it also came out at the same time as Bad Blood and didn't sell anywhere near Bad Blood. So is it a success because it's the book I wanted to write? Is it a failure because some other book sold more? You know, you just get in this sort of difficult headspace where I think you need, this is where Girard's stuff of like, what do you want? Not what other people want. Judge yourself on that criteria. And that's all you can think about.
Yeah, it's kind of that classic artist dilemma, right? Like the musician that just like makes like crap music or just does whatever he thinks, you know, the record labels want versus, you know, the musician or the band that makes the music that they really want to make. And, you know, they're maybe showing people. Well, first of all, I mean, it's authentic to them. But rather than just merely responding to the market, they're in some sense like transcending the market and writing the book that they really want to write or making the music that they really want to make. And that's how we move forward as a society, right? Like we make art that's not always responsive or sort of just beholden to sales, but we make it knowing that sometimes, you know, there are trade-offs, and in order to speak the truth doesn't always sell as well as the memes and the sound bites do. So that's like kind of the perennial artist tension, right? That's where we get the idea of a sellout from. So I think everybody experiences that. I think it's normal. And just recognizing that tension is just kind of the first part in the process, I think.
Yeah. And I think also thinking about the lifespan of the ideas. So, you know, Gerard does make these sort of dense books that are not particularly, you know, popular when they come out. But because there is a kernel of truth in them, and because he does reach, some influential people, over time he becomes, you know, one of the, I think, more important philosophers of the second half of the 20th century. And so it's like, yeah, what are you judging yourself based on how this idea fares in the market over 1 week? Or are you thinking about, does this do its job over a long period of time, whether it's for 10 people or 10 million people? Sort of expanding the view or the ruler that you're measuring with, I think also allows you to sort of get out of this sort of comparison trap too.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think that in the long run, I think that the truth wins out. And that's why classical wisdom, even though it may not be in fashion right now, I think, you know, what you're doing with Stoicism is great because, you know, 10, 12, 15 years from now, those truths are not going anywhere because they're truths. And I think, you know, widening your time frame is critical.
Well, Luke, this was awesome. I really appreciate it. And I love the book, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks so much, Ryan. I appreciate it, man.
Thanks so much for listening. If you could leave a review for the podcast, we'd really appreciate it. The reviews make a difference. And of course, every nice review from a nice person helps balance out the crazy people who get triggered and angry anytime we say something they disagree with. So if you could rate this podcast and leave a review on iTunes, that would mean so much to us and it would really help the show. We appreciate it. And I'll see you next episode. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V. Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.